Welcome to the Redbeard Embodiment Podcast. I am your host, Alex Green, and I'm on a mission to bring the power of embodiment to people all around the world. In this podcast, we explore how embodiment practices, trauma healing, and knowledge about the human nervous system can help us find our ground, discover new sources of meaning, and create connection in an ever-changing world. The deepest change is embodied change. All right. Good morning, everybody. Today, I have the big pleasure and honor to be sitting down with Doshin Shimroshi. It's definitely morning because here I'm in Boulder, Colorado. It's about 6 a.m. in Honolulu, where Shimroshi is joining us from. And Shimroshi and I have a connection through our Zen training lineage, going back at least about 20 years or so. Both of us have trained in the Chozenji style of Zen Buddhist meditation, or, you know, the tradition. And back in my early days, when I was about 20, 21, 22, I was doing a 1,000-day live-in training or residential training at the temple outside of Honolulu. And I had the good fortune of connecting with Shimroshi, who once a week would come pick me up from the temple in Kalihi and drive me out to his home near Makaha Beach in a different part of Oahu. And I got to do some Zen practice, but in combination with being out on the water with the outrigger rowing canoeing club. And so that was good fun. So that was sort of when I especially got to know Shimroshi in those early days. But I invited him on the podcast today to talk about our Zen training lineage and how the body is talked about and thought about and used as a tool for Zen meditation in our particular style and lineage. And then also with Shimroshi, a connection into his Hawaiian culture and lineage, which is a big part of his teaching and work in the world. And so I wanted to have a bit of a conversation about how the Hawaiian lineage and spirituality intersects with the Zen training as well. So Shimroshi, thank you so much for joining the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, what I always like to start with is just kind of going back in time a little bit, like how, you know, what are the influences and forces that led you kind of in the direction that you did. And I think of you as a little bit like me. I came to the Zen training through my father, Gordon Green Roshi, you know, when I was in my 20s and not knowing exactly what I was doing and kind of diving into the training in a way that really influenced me. And you earlier in time had live-in training and a deep connection to the dojo and Tanoi Roshi as well as your father. So I wonder if you could just tell a little bit about kind of the early days for you and how you got connected in.
I basically got introduced to it through my dad. He brought me up there, you know, to meet Roshi the first time. I was just there sitting in the kitchen and, you know, having that conversation. I remember when you were a little kid and you were running around. So I don't know if you could have had the same, because you were young. You were like 5 years old, maybe. Not even.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when I was like 5, 6, 7 and my sister was a little bit older, we would come up to the dojo, you know, dad would have some kind of work project or something like that. And we'd stay in the office and Yokiyama Roshi would set us up with video games or, you know. I remember we would go visit the dojo when we were young kids.
So, my introduction, I was much older when I met Tanoi Roshi through my dad. He took me up there. And I remember sitting in the kitchen and, you know, he was having one of the other live-ins serving us some tea, you know, and then he basically snapped at the you know, the guy living in, right? He says, because I guess the tea tasted bitter, right? And then I think the kid said, or the live-in, I forget his name, but he's trying to talk back to Tanayoshi, and Tanayoshi just snapped back and just shut up. That's the problem with you kids now. You always got something to say back, right?
Right.
And he goes, I got to fix this. And he goes, wouldn't you feel bitter if you just got thrown in a bunch of hot boiling water all at once? You know, so that was my first introduction into Tanayoshi as far as, you know, what he was.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think one of my first introductions too was seeing somebody, seeing him snap at somebody in the way that he was well known for. Part of his skillful means was a bit uncomfortable to experience. But so I know the feeling of seeing that in action.
And then I remember him, you know, saying something like, telling my dad, this is the kind of guys we need over here, right? You know, pointing to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, right. You know, like, I'm going to really shave my head and come over here. No way. You know?
Right.
And then he said, I can always tell people who smoke weed, you know, because they're sitting like this, you know, leaning forward, you know?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And then right there, I sat up straight.
Right.
So the reason why you lean forward is because your body doesn't have the weed makes your muscles lose its integrity.
Mm.
You don't have the integrity to hold your spine up. So that was so that's where it all started. And then, I eventually came back and asked him if I could stay in for 21 days, you know, I asked him if I could stay for the weekend.
Yep.
I go, no, it better you come for 21 days.
Yep.
And then, so I came in for 21 days. I remember coming in at like 5 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. And I was, you know, did the whole thing, 21 days. I think I built the steps during that time, those stone steps at the back of the wall, back of the hill.
Yeah.
When it came to 5 o'clock Sunday afternoon, 3 weeks later, I was running out the door. I was leaving, you know, I was out of there. I was escaping, you know, my time was up. Okay, done that. Gone.
Right, right.
And then about 3 years later, I ended up seeing him again. You know, I was kind of running wild.
Yeah.
In on Oahu, you know, doing all kinds of fun things, surfing and you know, working at night and partying. Then he said, okay, I'll make an offer for you. You can come stay with me again, but this time you can only leave when I think you're ready to leave. It might be 3 days. It might be 3 years. It might be a lifetime.
Mm.
You can only leave when I think you're ready to leave, you know? But then he tried to tone it down a little bit. But you can have 3 years, you know, it's relative. You can have 3 years in a few minutes, you know? He kind of conned me in more that way a little bit, right?
Right. You
know, that's my offer. Take it or leave it. Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. So I took his offer, you know.
Yeah.
I might be there for the rest of my life, right? So.
Mm. So when was that about? Was that in the 90s or when?
1988, around there. 88.
Okay.
88 or 89.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. How long did you end up staying?
About 3 years.
Yeah.
It came to the point where I wanted to stay. You know, I wanted to keep staying. They said, no, you got to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yes. Maybe on another time I'll share my story, but I had not quite the same offer from Tanayoshi, but something a little, I went up one day to see him, quite near the end of his life, and, was just basically paying my respects and having a bit of a final conversation. And somehow at the end of that conversation, I had agreed to stop college and live in and in a few months, start my 3-year live-in training. And I had, going into that conversation, I had zero intention of that being my path. But my fate was sealed and the deal was done. Yeah. So
there's a lot of stories.
Yeah. Yeah. What were, you know, when you sort of encountered both in that first 21 days or then, you know, I guess for the, you know, when you, you know, did spend this 3 years or there, what was, you know, and you're saying, you know, you're kind of surfing and working and partying. What was your impression of the dojo community or just kind of even the teachings? What were some of, what kind of hooked you in, if you remember?
It wasn't so much the environment, you know, the teachings, it was more him.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember when I first went to go visit him after my first introduction through my dad, I went to see him on my own. And then I remember asking, I think I was having problems with a relationship at the time, and I asked him, you know, I asked him, you know, do you ever have fights with your wife? Do you ever get into arguments with your wife? He goes, yeah, you know, he goes, you know, but what did he say? He said, but, you know, I couldn't have built this place without her, you know, you know, oh, this is what he said. He said, yeah. So does she ever get, I asked her, does she wife ever get mad at you? Yeah, but that's her problem. That's not my problem, you know. But I wouldn't have been able to build this place without you. I guess you just gotta appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's talk a little bit about, you know, kind of the role of live-in training, because, you know, because a lot of people, they get interested in meditation. Great. They learn how to sit. They might start sitting regularly, joining a class. In our style of training, there's often like a martial art or a fine art or, you know, some kind of Zen activity in combination with their meditation. And then some people, you know, if people get more serious, they may want to come for the sesshin, which is like a 7-day intensive period. So, you know, that's kind of one, you know, many people, of course, are working. And so their Zen training is their, you know, their daily practice, weekly practice, and they may do those intensive periods, but they don't have the freedom or flexibility to do sort of a full-time a residential live-in training. So let's just talk, since you and I both kind of went through that process, I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Like what is it about live-in training that's a bit unique in terms of how it functions?
Yeah. Unless you're living in 24/7, unless you won't know really what the experience is like unless you're doing that. You know, it's really difficult to get into that kind of deep spiritual training as a layperson. I mean, you can, but you know, it's easier, just the environment and just the schedule and just the energy, right?
Right.
And, you know, like what we learned, the most important thing at the dojo, which was Tonai Roshi's, you know, that was his MO, it was Kiai first, right?
Right.
So everything is Kiai first, you know. So right. before I went there for my 21 days, I knew it was going to be tough. So I had I had learned how to meditate in a different Indian tradition from India.
Yep.
But not the same kind of meditation.
Yep.
But similar. So I knew I had to be able to sit. I didn't want to go in there and start, you know, not handle. So I prepared myself a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's you know, the meditation is the basis of all of the training, you know, and then you have to, it's not just meditation per se, because there's so much meditation all over the place nowadays, right? You got mindfulness meditation and whatnot. Yeah. I don't even know all the different types.
Yeah.
But I know for us it worked, you know, and basically it's Kiai first and through the body, you know, how to you're sitting to build your Kiai.
Yeah. So pause for just a second. So I agree, you know, the Kiai first is the sort of the basic, the first and last rule, maybe, you know, kind of, as you say, the MO coming from Tonai Roshi, but just define that a little bit for somebody who's listening, who has not familiar with the term Kiai. Maybe, right. Could you just explain that a little bit?
So Ki'ai is energy. Hawaiians call it mana. You know, Indians will call it Shakti. You know, it's different names meaning the same thing, which is sort of your, I wouldn't say spiritual energy, but it's a universal energy, right? That it's a physical energy. It's not an intellectual concept, right?
And
the way you do it through meditation is through your core, or like 3 inches below your belly button, right?
Yep.
They might call that your hara, and the Hawaiians call it nao. And through that actual part of your body, through sitting and posture and breathing, is where you build it up, right? And so what we learned and what we teach is that this energy is built up, and you can actually feel it when your posture is correct, your breathing is correct, everything is what you're, you know, the technique of sitting is correct. Then you can actually feel this running through your bones. And it feels like warm. You can feel the heat of the energy running through your bones. And you know, so when you're sitting correctly, your heart, your hands will get warm. You know, so that's the fundamental prerequisite needed for all ways, whether it's martial arts, healing arts, fine arts. So from a fine art perspective, okay. So let me step back. So just to give you a better analogy. It's like, you know, you have all the stuff that's in your head up here, right? And all this, and that's the problems, right? All the delusions, all the thinking, all the angry or whatever, emotions, all up here. So you take that
distractions,
energy,
all that. Yep. Yep.
You put it down here below your belly button in your na'au.
Yeah.
It's kind of like getting fire, and then there's a pot of water, and you're heating up this pot of water in your na'au, and that creates steam, and that steam is energy that goes out through the body.
Right.
Well, now, from a fine arts point of view, like when we do calligraphy,
ceramics,
So the energy that you generate through your na'au comes out into your fingertips, goes into the brush, and that way, it goes into the ink. And it determines how the ink penetrates to the paper.
Right.
So, you know, so if you see that in a piece of calligraphy, like the ones you have behind you, right? Somebody that's really highly evolved, the way that if you look at the way that ink penetrates into the paper under a microscope, the lines are really clear.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fuzzy or it's
chaotic. Yeah. Yeah.
There's a specific clarity to it.
Yeah.
From somebody highly resolved. Evolve. So that same energy that can go into fine art determines how you're able to, you know, do body work, right?
Right.
The body work is dependent upon that.
Right.
Or whatever else you do, you know.
That
energy, it stays around. You know, it doesn't die with the person. Like I remember Tonoi Roshi gave me one of his bamboo shinais.
Bamboo sword from Kendo. Yeah.
Bamboo sword that, you know, he was a kendo, high ranking kendo master.
Yep.
He gave me one of it, and it has his ki'ai still in that sword.
Right.
Carry it. You feel it. You carry another sword, it feels small and lifeless.
For
his sword, it feels big.
Right. I have one too, and I agree, and I'll just sort of interject for a moment, because to me you're talking about, like you say, just the foundational piece of our lineage of Zen training, this ki'ai first. And I'm just going to share from my own experience. You know, I came into the training at, you know, 19, 20 years old, something like that, and I was coming from college. I was studying philosophy. All of me was here. And so Tanoi Roshi and some of the other teachers, they start talking to me about, oh, can you feel this? Can you feel that? And at first I couldn't. And I thought, this is total BS. But what was lucky for me, what I really think, you know, basically changed the course of my whole life was spending enough time with Tanoi Roshi and other teachers, where if I could suspend that, you know, my initial, you know, it didn't match my worldview and I didn't match my experience. But if I could set that aside I was able to experience very clearly, okay, wow, these people know what they're talking about, and there's something here that I know nothing about. And so became sort of so for me, I had to really sort of set down that, in my case, that real intellectual pursuits. And so when I started my live-in training, something I remember so clearly that I appreciate is Sean Tajima Sensei. I already had a hara belt. So you're talking about the, what is it? Is it Na'au or in Hawaiian?
Yeah.
So hara is the Japanese word, or tanden, or dantian would be the Chinese word for kind of that low energy center below the navel. And learning to breathe in that way is so critical. So we wear, when you're a new student or even later on, you wear, there's a thing called a hara belt, and you wrap it around your, below your navel. And the reason for it is it puts a little bit of pressure. So when you're breathing, you have something to kind of push against in the style of breathing that we practice, which is helping to develop the tanden and create the ki that Shin Roshi's mentioning right now. In any case, so on my first day of my live-in training, Tajima Sensei handed me a fresh new hara belt, and he said, "This is the closest thing that we have to a Bible in our tradition. Wear this every day. Wear it 24 hours a day. Only take it off when every few months you throw it in the laundry." And that's this. And other than that, that's basically all you need for these 3 years. Otherwise, just follow the daily schedule. And so for me, that was so important because it just, you know, I didn't do any reading of the Buddhist philosophy, nothing like that. And so those 3 years, it was all about a physical practice, waking up early, doing the meditation, making breakfast, shifting into the workday. It's a lot of manual work and using the body, from building and moving stones, as you said, but always keeping in mind, all right, what's happening in my hara? Can I stay centered or connected to this, this thing? And for me, the simplicity of just kind of moving through, just taking what comes at you, and but finding this centering, physical centering, with this hara belt, was kind of like the antidote that I needed to kind of find out that there's a different way to engage with the world and the present moment, not interfering by this kind of thinking. So that's that's kind of my own description of why that 24/7 kind of training was important for me.
I wasn't too much into the hara belt.
You didn't use the hara belt?
I wasn't into it. Yeah, honestly, yeah, I hardly ever wore it.
Wow, we had a completely different experience. You hardly ever wore it?
Pushing it at one point, and I put it on, but to me it was irritating. It was in the, you know?
Yeah, yeah. For me, it became like a second, you know, I felt weird without it, you know?
So you know, I mean, you use that to facilitate that pressure in your below your navel, right? We call it pico, below your pico. You use it to facilitate your pressure.
Yeah. But
one other, I forgot to mention, you know, as far as, well, we didn't really go through the mechanics, and we're not going to do that here, but.
Yeah.
Besides taking that pressure from up here.
Yeah.
Putting it down there. The important thing to know is that your anus got to be slightly closed. Mm. If you that's really, really important. So if your anus is slightly closed, that automatically kind of puts pressure below your navel.
That
was more of my hara belt, was making sure my asshole was slightly closed. So, you know, so you, and the reason you do that also, the way Tanaya Roshi explained it, is that when your anus is slightly closed, you can't think at the same time.
Right.
You know, you can't have things going over here at the same time. So he used to say like this. So if you see somebody walking down their street with a frown in their head, you know their asshole is wide open.
Yeah. So I totally agree. And, you know, the tension and in the anal sphincter kind of relates to your, because, you know, I think a mistake in the beginning with Hara, you know, the developing that lower center is thinking it's just the tendon, but it's a whole, it's kind of how you organize tension in your pelvic floor, in your whole hips and pelvis, how that tension creates centeredness or connects to the rest of your body up all the way up to your face and down to your toes. Yeah. And to me, the part of the reason I think that the martial arts is so strongly emphasized in, you know, in that training was that in martial arts, you're and also of course in fine arts, but at a more refined level, but in martial arts, you're kind of learning how to keep that physical centeredness in relationship to the rest of the body in various sort of applications and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. When you're centered down there, and then especially when you're sitting, then you can start to relax everywhere else.
Right.
Right. You just go through your whole body and, you know, just consciously letting things go. So you become completely relaxed, you know.
Yeah.
And then there's the intellectual mind part component that you through Zazen, you know, the form of meditation that we do, to bring that intellectual stuff back into the body, you know, is constantly bringing it back to the body. And that's basically, you know, what we call shugyo, which is, you know, one definition of shugyo is like a deep spiritual forging, right? But I like the one that Yokoyama Roshi uses all the time, and that's his definition of shugyo is more like it, not to let the mind stop, right? So all of the problems that we have, whether it's physical or mental, you know, kind of start from this mind that gets stopped. It's stopped and attached to this or that, right?
Yeah.
From a martial arts point of view, if somebody is wielding their sword and my mind gets stuck on their sword, I'm dead, right? If my mind gets stuck on my sword, I'm dead, right? So the training is about how to not let the mind stop.
Yeah.
So for us, doing Zazen, the thought comes in while you're sitting. What we do is we bring it in when you're first learning, we bring it down by counting your breaths. So one breath is one count.
Yeah.
Short inhale and a long exhale. Right.
Yeah.
You try to breathe, you know, like maybe one time in a minute would be ideal.
Yeah.
Whereas most people breathe about 17 times a minute. Neurotic people breathe faster.
Yeah.
So when we have a thought, we bring it back to the breathing.
Yeah.
And slowly the thoughts start to disappear. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you can get from there, you go deeper into your meditation.
Right.
As through that practice, building up your ki, you know, and you know, making it stronger and stronger, which affects, you know, your ability to do body work.
Right. Well, so let's talk for a minute about, you know, the kind of the curriculum that Tanoi Roshi and his teacher, Omori Sogen Roshi, kind of developed. Well, because Omori Sogen, Japanese, a Zen master from in Japan, had trained in Zen, but also extensively in kendo or sword arts, and then also extensively in calligraphy, a traditional Japanese calligraphy. And so the phrase that got kind of brought down into our style of training is this phrase of Zen Ken Sho. So Zen as in Zen meditation, Ken sword, and Sho brush, referring to this idea that there's that the development process, as you said earlier, to evolve oneself using Shugyo or that sort of deep forging, or, you know, kind of training at that deep level, can be done through different angles: meditation, martial arts, fine arts, and that there's a reason why there's a benefit to exploring from a few different points of view. Can you just explain a little bit either for you personally or even just in general, why is it important to kind of look at things through those few different angles like that?
Well, Ken Scholl is a, you know, what that describes is well, the training is basically how to not let the mind stop.
Right.
And so that you can see your true self nature, right?
Yes.
So, I think that I'm not really good with all the Japanese terms.
Right.
Honestly, I don't really remember what
you're not attached. You're not attached. I like it. Okay, good.
But you know, a lot of I know ki kan mio, right? You know, I kind of know what that means. But kensho, right. kensho is basically enlightenment. It's an enlightenment experience. So kensho is when you see your true self nature. That's when you become enlightened.
Right.
You know, and what is that? You know, what does that mean?
Right. But I guess what I'm talking about is like the Zen and then like the martial arts, fine arts, and sitting. So because the way that I always, how I've thought about it is, you know, sitting is in some ways the easiest circumstances to refine your breathing, learn to slow it. It's kind of a, in a way, artificial environment because there's, you know, there's not much coming at you other than what's coming up from inside, you know, your pain or your own thoughts or things like that. But then in the martial arts, it's very physical. And in the fine arts, there's more sort of a refinement. And like I know for you, you know, a lot of martial arts. And then I've, you know, you're very artistic with your painting. And so I know you've kind of studied through those three ways, sitting meditation, martial arts meditation, if we want to call it, and fine arts meditation. To you, do you think it's important to kind of, for you, that you work through those different ways to kind of integrate them?
Yeah, I mean, definitely you train in one art. So say you might have karate and you might have music, right?
Yeah,
so you train in one art, you come and the principles of each of a martial arts and fine arts are the same principles, right?
Yeah.
They're cooking. The same principles of cooking are the same principles of judo, right?
Yeah.
Or kendo. Principles of time and space and energy, right? You know, when you're cooking something, the food has to be clear. You know, it has to, you know, same with when you're throwing a punch or you're you know, you're drawing a line.
Yeah.
So when you train in one art and you come to a block in that one art, you're gonna find the breakthrough for that same block in another art.
Mm.
You know, so that's the importance of having all those different things. You know, that's why at the dojo basically you're training in fine arts, martial arts, and liberal arts.
Mm-hmm.
So you do need to, you know, I mean, that's what you train in one to find the breakthrough in the other.
Yeah, yeah. And to be, you know, also to be a kind of, you don't want to be, I guess it's sort of like, you know, sometimes you'll make the comment like, all right, well, somebody like, you know, Michael Jordan or LeBron James, surely they're in a high level of functioning when they're in the zone playing basketball. We talk, you know, even in non-Zen Western culture, we talk about being in a flow state or being in the zone. And people can develop that where in their area of expertise, where they're operating at a very high level, you know, a non-stopping mind and all that kind of thing. But in Buddhism and in Zen training, the question is, okay, that's great. It's useful to develop it in a specific context, but in a way that's also, but all right, how is that showing up in other aspects of your life? When you wake up in the morning, when you're having an argument with your wife, all these sort of more mundane circumstances rather than being on the basketball court or in a sword match or something like that. To me, I've always looked at the martial arts, fine arts, sitting. It's in a way, or the liberal arts. How do we become well-rounded, where the principles of Zen can show up more or less in any circumstance? What do you think?
So, you know, when you talk about being in the zone, the guy who was in the zone was Tanai Roshi. I mean, he was basically, you know, I think he defines what it means to be in the zone.
Okay? Yeah, me too. Yeah.
You, as you train yourself to not let your mind stop, you know, not let your mind get taken up by the delusion. Because once the mind attaches to a thought, and then your mind stops at that point, and then you can't move. You know, that's why the samurai trained, you know, so that they wouldn't get their minds, or they'd be very vulnerable if their mind got stuck on any one thing. So for Tanai Roshi, you know, that's what he taught us, is not how to let the mind stop. And it comes to the point where, as a man, he would always say this. He would say, one man training himself is better than 10,000 people doing social work, right? And what that means is that, you know, by him training himself, he would be, his hara or his ki would be so strong that anybody that would come in his presence would forget about their problems, would forget about their fears.
Right.
You know? And their minds would become calm, you know. Right. From a healing perspective, you know, somebody sick and comes around him, you know, it has you know, a huge effect on
influence.
That.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the importance of him training himself, rather than, you know, somebody telling you, oh, you got to do this, this, and this. It's just his presence was so strong that it had that effect on people. It was said that his ki was so strong that he could put everybody within a 2-mile radius into samadhi, you know, and have no mind, I mean, have a calm mind about their problems. That's how strong his ki was. You know, the zone, you know.
Yeah. So. Well, and it connects to, you know, he would frequently say, this is the one of the first things he told me was, you know, this is about who you are, not what you do. So it's about being rather than doing, and certainly not about thinking. So what you're pointing to is, you know, that super high level of development of ki to the point where he has that sort of presence and influence at that scale and magnitude. It's about somebody who just took the pursuit of being, you know, basically to a level that not too many people get to.
Yeah, you mentioned him. You know, you mentioned Omori Sogen.
Yeah,
you know, I remember once asking Tanai Roshi, what was it about Omori Sogen that made you want to train with him? Because Omori Sogen, he's like a little guy. He's like 5 feet tall, if not even that. So I asked him, what was it about Omori Sogen that made you want to train with him?
Yeah.
He wasn't afraid to die, you know? I could just kill him, but he wasn't afraid to die. You know, so that's why he decided to train with him. Because he was looking for somebody and he couldn't find anybody like that. He was looking for years. He finally found Omori Sogen.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, could we talk a little bit about the connection? You know, so the healing arts aren't sort of like, you know, it's not like a core focus. It's not like everybody who does Zen training, it's not that healing arts is always going to be a part of that. But there was some of that around through Dub and Audrey and probably others. Tanoi Roshi himself, sort of innately, but also through his high level of development, through martial arts and other things, you know, basically just incredibly gifted as a healer in various ways. And of course, that's what I ended up becoming interested in, as in a way I thought of it as my fine art after, you know, a number of years of martial arts. I wanted to take those practices into body work, which has been kind of the direction that I ended up going. But could you talk a little bit about, you know, Dub and Audrey and how sort of the healing arts were your own background in that period of time?
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky because I got to formally train with Dub.
Yeah.
You know, and Audrey was always there. But I also got to learn from Tanai Roshi, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, Dub had trained with Ida Rolf, as we all know. you know, and Moshe Feldenkrais and Barry, Ron Barry.
Lauren Barry,
You know, so he, you know, so when I, and when I lived in was when Dub was living in.
Okay.
Dub was a lay person, right? He didn't live in there full time like how we did round the clock. Yep. But he had a special agreement with Tonai Roshi where he would sleep over at night, meditate in the morning, and meditate every morning. But he would go off and do his work outside, which is was body work all over the world. So, but Dub's work was more like to you know, through like Rolfing, he developed Zen therapy. Was the structural integration from what I understand, right?
Yep.
Tonai Roshi's method was a little bit different. You know, his method was evolved out of being able to fix injuries from martial arts, right?
Yep.
That's how, for him, that's how the body work evolved for his training out of martial arts.
Yep.
So his stuff was more designed like if you come to him like you got totally wrecked in a car accident, that kind of trauma.
Yep.
He was, you know, he was good at fixing that.
Yeah.
What I learned from Tonai Roshi a lot, I mean, that was really useful, that I, when it comes to like the nervous system, not so much, you know, I don't know that much about the nervous system, but what he did show me is how to put nerves back into their grooves.
Okay.
And how to physically look for them.
Yeah.
How they were, you know, how they lined up in the body.
Yep.
And develop the touch in order to feel where it is or where it's supposed to be and it's not. And it doesn't take a lot of, you know, it's really fine work. It's not a lot of muscle.
Right. Yeah.
And that was an important decision, which was different from Dub. Dub then was just go in there and just, you know, just go in there and you know, just no mercy.
A little bit more brute force in some ways.
Kind of brute force, but it worked.
Yeah.
You do it correctly. I mean, it can not work if it's not. Again, it depends on the person, right?
Right.
How they do it, right?
Yeah.
And their, you know, their intuitive perception, right?
Yep. Yep.
You know, how much to give, right?
How
much to give. Along the sides of, you know, coming to training, right, is the question of, you know, when you talked about Kensho and all of that stuff, the question is like, who am I, right? Right. When you want to find out your true self, who is your true self?
Right.
So you're asking the training is about finding out who you are. What is my true self? So, you know, all questions come down to that question. Who am I, right? And from a bodywork perspective, or just a general, you know, not even bodywork, but from the same question is, why am I suffering? Right? You have whatever it is, you know, in your life, is why am I suffering? Is the same question as who am I? So this is why we train, why we come here, because we want to discover who our true self nature is.
Right.
So what is that? You know.
Right.
And it's not something intellectual. And maybe I'm going to get ahead of myself, but it's something that can't be known through just general knowledge. It's unknown. We'll talk about that later.
I mean, I think that's an important thing to say. And I think what's so strong in Zen, but also just Shugyo, or that deep spiritual forging or whatnot that you referred to, is this idea that, you know, it's not a pursuit. We're not looking for a simple answer or a superficial answer to a question. In Zen, we're looking at what is the very, very root of experience, or what is the very root or foundation of one's being. And that is not something that's something that can only be arrived at through a consistent, you got to keep looking past the superficial answers to those questions, you know, that question, who am I? We're looking for getting to that at a very deep level. But by being able to connect to that very deep level, then there, in a way, it's a way of getting to the root of many problems, whether that's our psychological barriers or problems or from a healing perspective. So Zen is a path that's essentially trying to get to that very foundation of who am I.
Right. You know, and I let me see how to put this. From a practical sense, right? When you think about the things that cause the suffering, right? It's and where the mind gets stopped and where the mind becomes deluded is when it becomes dualistic, right? You know, you get stuck in good, you know, and bad, and you know, right and wrong, rich and poor, ugly and beautiful, right? Back and forth. It never ends, you know. That's the suffering, is going back and forth between the two, the mind getting stuck on one or the other. Mm. So as you start to find out who, or try to search for who you are, you know, and then you go, well, who am I? Am I this person in this body? And I goes, is that me? No, is that me with this title? No, that's not me. And then you find out who you are doesn't exist, actually. Right. And at that point, then you really can find out who your true self. But it's not something that you not existing is something that intellectual concept that you just believe, right? Till you come to the physical experience. So right. What is that, right?
Yeah. Well said. Yeah.
So let me step back. For Hawaiians, this is the way Tonai Roshi explained it to me. How did the first Hawaiians go to some place they'd never been before? Right? It was unknown. If they knew about it before, it wouldn't have been unknown, right? It would have been known, but it was unknown. Mm-hmm. Intuitive perception was off by just one degree. We wouldn't exist as a culture today. You know? So we would have bypassed and we would all be dead. So the mm-hmm. essence culture is the ability to know this unknown. So how can you know about something that's unknown, right? And this is what the Zen training does. You know, it develop a way to know the unknown so that your intuitive perception is correct. So how do we do that? It's not just an intellectual thing to do it. Again, it has to come back to the body.
Right.
So to intuitively know what cannot be known, it goes back to your hara, where we sit. When your hara is set correctly, your sphincter muscles slightly closed, 180 degrees with your vision, long exhale. Mm. Everything else is relaxed. Mm. If everything is pressured down there, whatever decision you make is intuitively going to be the right decision. So, you know, we've done all kinds of exercise that help you practice and facilitate that.
Yeah.
So that's where the intuitive perception becomes. So even when you're doing body work, you know, your intuitive perception is developed and is enhanced and is facilitated by your ability to you know, have your hara set correctly. Then you're going to know, okay, there's something wrong here in the body,
right,
or not, where to go. So that's an important thing to remember.
No, I think that's really important because and as I'm now teaching body work and Zen integration, body work is what I'm calling the integration that I've done. That's exactly the distinction that I'm making is, you know, when you're one way to learn body work or many different things is you learn various techniques or what might be called a clinical reasoning. It's sort of like an analytical process to understand, oh, well, if this muscle is like this, then this must be like this. And first I need to do this. And this is, so that level of reasoning would be an intellectual or an analytical reasoning. Now there's some value in that. It's not that that's incorrect, but what I'm much more interested in when I'm teaching body work and certainly when I'm practicing body work is how to, okay, sure, I learned all of those things, but a much more effective way for me to be as a body worker is when I can be in that centered state, just as you describe it, collected in the hara, 180 degree vision, relaxation other than the sort of connection into the ground. Now, from that place and engaging through touch or even not through touch with a person, it's in Zen, we call it kan or intuitive perception, as you say, that can start to guide the way. That's a much more, that's a much deeper way of a much more accurate way of working with somebody than relying upon this sort of so-called clinical reasoning, which again has its place. I'm not trying to discredit that. But mm-hmm. when we look at a Zen art or a Zen body work, that's something that I'm really emphasizing as well, exactly as you described it.
Yeah. Tonai Roshi would, you know, and they both would, you know, through their work, you know, I was lucky, I was able to be around their work. They would teach me certain things by being around them. And, you know, it came through working on different clients. You know, whoever came in that needed work. I remember there's one guy, he had cancer, he's terminally ill. He was in so much pain that he would have to go and get on his motorcycle and just go 100 miles an hour at night, you know, thinking that he might kill himself. You know, but we worked on him, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was just a matter of going in. And for cancer, right, the way Tonai Roshi taught me is that you want to make the rest of the body good. Everything around the cancer, you try and make it as good so that the cancer can, it will overpower and the cancer will diminish. You know, that was his approach. Make the rest of the body really all clean.
Yeah.
And then you diminish that. So that's how I would approach people that have, you know, something, you know, wrong with them.
Right.
And sometimes it worked, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it's just the, you know, the causes and conditions in your life, meaning the cause and conditions of this other person's life and whatever they are, you know, it's for some reason it's their time to be healed or not.
Right.
Being with some people, it wasn't there. No matter what you did, there's nothing you can do. It was their time to go.
Right.
There was that side of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, to be able to see it clearly, right, like we say, Khan, to see what it is clearly, again, you have to be set, you know, down here to know, you know, intuitively whether or not you're doing the right thing or doing, you know, what's needed. But it really comes down to that. You know, so even for Tonai Roshi and his martial arts, for example, you know, it came to the point where his martial arts was beyond form already, you know. I remember he described it as a story, the level of the martial arts that he was at would be like, you know, he would have his shinai and he'd be resting on it like this, right? And then he get up to stretch and he'd stretch it, boom, right when somebody is attacking him. As he's stretching, he's hitting the guy in the head, right? You know? And for, you know, that's really phenomenal. I mean, that's really something. Right. I mean, another story he had was there was this one monk, you know, and the teacher would always, he's the monk's, the master, Zen master of this monk, would always crack him on the back of the head, right, wherever he was.
Right. Right?
Yep. And then, you know, the kid kept getting nailed all the time.
Yep.
And then thought that he was training out, he was going to get good at it.
Yeah.
So he was going to go attack the teacher back.
Right.
The teacher and get him back at him. He was right when he tried to hit the teacher had just finished wiping a pot. I was going to put it on the shelf and hit the kid in the head.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and so that's how it is, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so that story, you know, that's coming from the chapter on swordsmanship in Suzuki's Zen and Japanese culture, and it's such a good example. I mean, and your example of Tonai Roshi existing within that level, that particular teacher existing, that again, to me, that really exemplifies. It's about being. It's just your. It's it that's totally relying upon purely 100% on intuition. No conscious action whatsoever, yet somehow you are in in flow with, you know, I guess what we would call the Tao, you know, in Taoism, or, you know, basically in alignment with the universe.
It's basically like the mind of intention has no dwelling place. Mm. The mind of intention has no dwelling place. So, you know, you're not, there's kind of like a fine line in this work where, you know, it's like, again, you have these causes and conditions of this person's life, whatever his karmic condition, whatever, and his physical conditions just happens to come into your space.
Right.
You are. Or yeah. That maybe from what your causes and conditions can affect that person in that moment of now,
yep.
at the time.
Yeah.
And that's all there is, you know. So it's not like it's like getting into a fight, right? Like nowadays you got guys, they're training and they're training for martial arts for, you know, to fight in MMA or whatever, you know, to win a tournament.
Yeah.
Whereas Tanori Roshi's martial arts might be where you don't even train for all of that. And he might not ever have a fight, you know, maybe just that one fight, which would result in not all of the training that he had.
Yeah.
Training gives him the ability, but the actual fight would just be, you know, going to lift, you know, stretch out.
Yeah.
And take care of what, or if somebody's attacking him and he just, you know, had his keys or something and flew it into the guy's eye. You know. So
yeah.
That's
yeah.
the same with body work.
Yeah.
Same kind of connection. For me, I used to do it as a business, but I don't do it anymore as a business. I do it only when I meet somebody that needs my help, whether it's a friend or somebody that's, you know, and then either it helps or it doesn't, you know?
Yeah. No, but what you're saying is that your best work is when you have no plan. You're encountering the person and whatever is going to emerge from that will.
Whatever it is that you've had, you know, that you learn from all the different things that you learn. You know, and I haven't learned that much, but you might not need to have all that much. It's just one little thing, you know,
that
can help.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, could you talk a little bit about, you have a Hawaiian ancestry, not only, you know, genealogically, but, you know, an important part of your work in the world, all along and now is through your Hawaiian heritage, and spirituality. And I know for you, Zen is just one culture. Hawaii is just one culture. There's something, connecting, you know, at a more basic level than the words and the culture. Could you talk a little bit about how your Hawaiian, spirituality and Zen, connect?
Basically, you know, Zen, Zen and Hawaiian culture basically have the same essence, you know. You can call it poke, which is raw fish, you know, or you can call it maguro in Japanese. It's the same thing. Mm. So the essence of both are the same. In the Hawaiian, you know, Tanai Roshi isn't Hawaiian by blood. Mm-hmm. He's like third generation Japanese that grew up in Hawaii. Mm. He's a local boy. Mm-hmm. And he intersected with an ancient tradition of Hawaiian culture, you know, through my auntie, Pilahi Paki. That was my great grandmother's niece. And my great grandmother had two sisters, and they married two Paki brothers, and Pilahi Paki was one of them. Mm. So the story of Pilahi Paki is that she was a telephone operator with Hawaiian Tel. And she kept hearing these voices through her headset, you know, old telephone before cell phones. And the voice kept telling her to come to Kona in the Big Island. You know, so she kept telling her that. So she eventually flew to Kona, and she meets this guy. His name is Naluihini Kaupua, and he's 105 years old. He's on his deathbed. And this guy was a champion rodeo cowboy. He was a lua master, which is the Hawaiian martial arts, bone-breaking martial arts. He was a master of that. He knew where all the springs in Hawaii were. You know, he knew the land. He knew the, you know, the stories of that. He had full knowledge. He's 105 years old. He's on his deathbed, lying down. When she reaches him, he levitates straight up. This is the story. And then he basically passes everything to her. And from that point on, she could speak Hawaiian fluently, where she couldn't before.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so she was a famous kahuna or you know, spiritual teacher that, you know, a lot of things in Hawaii evolved. And she talked about aloha spirit, right? And, you know, the different meanings of aloha spirit. She would teach every, you know, people about that.
Mm.
Eventually, before she passed away, she was kind of sick, and Dub and Audrey and my dad took her to meet Tonai Roshi. And then when she could barely walk, they had to kind of carry her in. And then Tonai Roshi came down with his, you know, with his full ceremonial robes, and he started to work on her, fed some ki through her feet, you know, which incidentally is one of, you know, since I mentioned that, is a really powerful way of helping people, especially when they're dying.
Or right. feeding ki or chi through the feet.
Right. And just facilitating. And that's part of the process of clearing up the body so you can, you know, getting rid of the blockages so that the ki can be fed. But it's his ki, you know, that's body work and it's, you know, it's ultimate form.
Yeah.
To me. So he fed ki into her so she could live another 30 days. And then she got up. You know, she kind of pretty much just got up where she could barely stand. And then a voice came out of her and said that there were witnesses, and this is documented in Dub's book.
Yep.
Where, you know, she basically passed everything to Tonai Roshi.
Yeah.
From that day on, he would speak Hawaiian. Right? Mm. So he would talk to me in Hawaiian, and he would only say things when it was important, you know. He would say words in Hawaiian, and he doesn't know what I'm saying. I mean, what he's saying. I don't know what he's saying. I would have someone else interpret it. But it was always important things.
Hmm.
So before he passed away, you know, I asked him, I said, you know, you have the lineage that you've inherited coming down from Shakyamuni Buddha. Mm-hmm. Because Tonai Roshi carries the lineage, the direct Dharma lineage, as it came from Shakyamuni Buddha to his student, and from that student to the next student. You know, maybe Shakyamuni Buddha had a number of students, but there's only one that carries that pure teaching. Well, that tradition passed down from India for 27 teachers to the disciples, and then into China, 27, the 28th one went to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
First one in China being Bodhidharma, and then 28th went to Japan, and then in Japan there were 27, and the 28th one was either Tonai Roshi or Mori Sogyen, but they were the ones that to bring it here to the West.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that lineage, Tonai Roshi. You have all your Zen masters under you. What about Atipilahi? Who are you going to pass that to?
Mm.
And he said, you know, for me, it was a really great privilege that they showed me all of that stuff, but it's not up to me. It's up to them. It might be you. It might be somebody else. You know, that's how it is in the whole tradition.
Yep.
So that was, you know, that's basically what happened.
Yeah.
So that tradition goes on here, you know, and that's a way of for our ancient Hawaiians to talk or to teach or to be with or to help, you know, in this time. Because on that level for Tonai Roshi, I mean, he would tell me stories. You know, he'd talk about times when he would, you know, he would describe, you know, these big beings coming down from the universe, like huge big beings, or he would describe things, you know, really out of this world kind of stuff. Or he would describe talking to somebody that had died 100 years ago, right? Of a high priest kahuna that he had talked to, that he had met, you know. So on that level, it's all beyond time and space, right? There's the past and the future. It's beyond past and future. It exists in the now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, real difficult to explain that, but
yeah,
you know, that's kind of what, you know, so there is, that exists out there. You know, you have where Hawaiians come down and they, that lineage going back who knows where.
Yeah.
You know, it exists. You know?
What you captured a lot of what you've just shared in a really beautiful text, that Kekua's daughter, my dad had a role helping to edit that and whatnot. What do you consider your work with this at this stage of your life?
Well, in Kekua's daughter, you know, it was a book written by a student of Pilahi Paki, and that book had really, you know, it had, your dad called me one day, right? And he's like, you know, I hadn't heard from him in years. And he called me and he said that he was telling me about this book, that it was a little pamphlet that every time he'd go into the library in the dojo, he'd see this book, and it moved him, you know, and he wanted to republish it, right? Because it was out of print. Mm-hmm. And so he called my dad one day, and he said, my dad goes, oh, who's this? You know, he goes, it's Gordon. He goes, oh, how's it, Gordon? He goes, yeah. He wanted to ask my dad if he could republish the book. Mm-hmm. So he talks to my dad, goes, how's your family? You know, how's this? You know, he does everything to evade answering the question.
Yeah, yeah.
And Gordon had to just cut him short. Goes, Albert, can I or can I, you know? And yeah. Then my dad goes, well, you know, Gordon, you'll know when it's the right time for you to do it, right? You'll know when it's the right time. It's up to you.
Yeah.
Gordon felt that it was the time to do it. So that's why he's calling me, because he heard that somehow I knew Auntie Pilahi and all this. I had some background about it. I told her, yeah, we were related to her. Mm-hmm. I never actually met her, but you know, my brother had done a lot of work with her. Mm-hmm. Some of my cousins had met her, but I never actually met her. Only of her I knew through Tanoi Roshi. Mm-hmm. And sometimes she would be talking to him after she passed. And Tanoi Roshi, Auntie Pilahi, he said this, this, and this. You got to do this, this, and this. You know, and so I would always listen. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Auntie Pilahi, Gordon wanted to write this book, and so he's telling me about this. So I explained all of this. So he's kind of blown away that there was that much of a connection. Mm. And he goes, well, you know, if they ever, you know, I was explaining to them the tradition, and he goes, well, if they ever, if you ever get any, you know, insight from them, you know, let me know what it is. So I go, well, at the start of this conversation, this is what they said.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. But there were these words that came. I don't have the words right in because I don't remember what it was. But it was at that time, so I wrote it down at the beginning of the phone call. Those words came to me right when I was talking to Gordon.
Yep.
And, I told him, "Well, this is what they said. I don't know what it means, but I think it was something like Kahai Ilia Ava'a or something like that. Kahai Ilia Ava'a, something like that, and." I don't know what it means, but I'll get back to you, Gordon. So I looked at, you know, I have to translate literally what it means, you know, get the definitions. But basically what it meant was that this book was a vessel to declare like extreme or profound, what do you call it, profound concepts, you know. To declare profound concepts or to teach, you know, really deep things. Mm-hmm. what the meaning, but something like that. Mm-hmm. That's what this book was supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And I emailed that to him, you know, after I translated it, mm-hmm. and which was right what the book is. So, you know, that kind of thing. So it comes, those things happen, you know, our ancestors, what I've learned from this stuff is that, and what the book talks about, how the sounds of the language, like the I, A, E, O, U, contain, you know, certain elements of creation or whatever. And when you say those sounds, those sounds, whether it's the name of a person, bring that whole being into the moment right then and there, and it exists.
Yeah.
So if I say the word Pele, which is the goddess of fire from the volcano, I say Pele, Pele exists right in this moment as me, as you, as everyone in that same moment. And through this tradition, Hawaiians will show you this, you know, they'll show me this, you know. where they will show certain things. And you know, what I've learned is that, so your ancestors, as soon as you say their name, they're there with you, you know, whether you believe it or not, whether you see it or not, because it exists in something that's unknowable, it's the unknown. Which also, you know, since I'm talking about that, when you ask yourself, who am I, and you find out that you don't exist, it's unknown, right? So that moment where you understand your true self nature is when you realize the unknown, right? And that there's no separation between knowing and not knowing, between knowing and the unknown. And it's not something that is an abrupt awakening. It happens like in a moment, like in an instant. It's an abrupt, and it does. It's not dependent upon any training that you've had, anything. There's nothing that is needed to have that experience. It can happen, you know. Everything that needs to get out of the way, right?
Yeah.
So the higher level of the Zazen is getting into the, you become to the point where you're almost unconscious as you go so deeply into your Zazen, into your breath, that you don't even know that you exist, that you're not there, right? So that moment, that abrupt awakening, is when that moment where you're so deep, that unconsciousness becomes conscious of itself. So, and then at that point, you break through all duality. There's no difference between life and death, you know. There's no difference between you and the universe. So when the Buddha seen the morning star, he understood, I am, you know, he understood the truth at that moment. Yeah. For people, it was different things. So that's the whole, all of this is for to get to that one point and beyond that. Because, you know, just knowing that is not enough. You know, that experience is what you do with it. Getting back to with the Hawaiian stuff, in the book it talks about the letters and the sounds. Like A is the elemental fire, you know, the creative element. So those sounds are and that vowel, and when you attach it to a consonant, it determines. So you attach it to the consonant K. So you have ka. K is a more masculine, energetic, outgoing things. So ka is like to go out creatively, you know. So those are some of the things with the language. So the sounds that come through the Hawaiian language, which I don't speak, but when they come, they tell you certain things, and it's either going to be delusional or it's going to be clear, you know. And that's a way that I've found that ancient Hawaiian culture can actually is right here with us today.
Is still being transmitted and in the present moment.
Yeah.
Speaking of kind of words and sounds, I introduced you as Doshin Shimroshi, which is, you know, your Zen, your priest name and Zen and title. And your Hawaiian name, Navelu Nakai. Can you talk a little bit about the meaning of that, Navelu Nakai?
Okay, so Navelu Nakai, that's the name that Auntie Pilahi said that our family is supposed to carry. So, and it was carried by the oldest boy. And if there wasn't the oldest male, then the oldest female would take that name. So I'm Navelu Nakai Ehiku, which is number 7. My dad was number 6. His father was number 5. His mother, my great-grandfather, my great-grandmother was number 4, you know, and then it goes back to number 1, Navelu Nakai Ikahi. And Navelu means, Navelu Nakai, Nakai is like the sea, and Navelu means like the feathering, you know, like feathering, so it's the feathering sea. And I'm, you know, literally Navelu, the feathering sea, I figure that name maybe came down from as navigators that they were, the first Hawaiian to come, you know, or it came back from that way back tradition, because the feathering sea is kind of like the really perfect seas for going long distance, not too rough, not too weak, but just smooth feathering seas that take you where you need to go.
I see.
Those first Hawaiians that been somewhere they never knew before.
Yeah.
They came to somewhere they never knew before, right? So that's right. What kind of, but for me, that's just on my dad's side of the family. Mm. That tradition goes back through genealogy through them.
Yeah.
Then on my mom's side, my genealogy goes back through both my mom's mother and her father goes back to some of the royal families over here. But the one thing that's interesting is that they were the two sides that come down were enemies at a certain point. So it's from opposite sides of the royal families, enemies of them come down to us. So we have both.
Yeah. Well, and it's so, and appropriately, you're sitting on your sailboat right now. And could you talk in
little cave over here?
Yeah, which is wonderful. And from my understanding, from what you shared with me back in December, you have a lifetime on the water, of course, surfing and the paddle canoes and everything like that. And but sort of some circumstances arose, and this sailboat came into your world, and you had some ideas around bringing sailing and that side of the kind of the water part of your culture. Share just a little bit about that if you're willing to.
I always remember what Tonai Roshi told me. He goes, Hawaiians were a seafaring people. That's how he started the conversation. How did they go where they'd never been before, right? Hawaiians are a seafaring people. So, having lived in Makaha for a long time, I was close to some of the, to one of the guys who was one of the original Buffalo Keolana. He was one of the original crew members of the Hokulea, which is a sailing canoe that went from Honolulu to Tahiti. And it was always his, he wanted to always teach. He was a well-known big wave surfer. He's pretty much the guy who's the matriarch of Makaha Beach. And, but he always, I had a lot of real close conversations. He was really close with Mao from Micronesia, who was the one who taught all the navigators, this intuitive tradition of sailing using just the stars and intuition. And how to go from one place to another. Mm. And also, through my conversations with Buffalo, he always wanted to teach younger kids how to sail. He was more into that. And then I just happened to run across his boat. Somebody was, pretty much it just came into my lap. And that's what we want to do with it, is to teach kids how to sail, teach them generation and then learn about that, because it's just another art, it's another fine art. The same principles apply to this and everything else.
There's
a certain amount of responsibility you have, a lot of intuitive perception that you need. You got to know when to go, when to do things at the right time.
So
just another method for training,
Very cool. Well, this has been a rich conversation, to say the least. Is there anything you feel like we missed? Anything you want to make sure that we include?
One thing I'll say is that you have all these traditions to teach you, but when it comes down to shugyo, there's only you, and if you know how to sit, you can train deeply on your by yourself, just on your own. But it's important to do it every day, But it's important to not just meditate, but to do the kind of where kind of a more of a, I wouldn't say stricter, but more structured form of meditation. Because the thing about meditation that may people that haven't done it, they don't realize that it becomes painful. Right, it can be you get sore at certain points, and those are just thoughts in your mind as well. So you can break through that. So you need that kind of resistance to really push through. To give it to put it into perspective. I remember before when I first learned how to meditate, I was taught you could lay down on the floor and meditate, right? Mm. You know. So if you compare that to Zazen, you know, it's meditation, right? But it's not really, because when you're lying down, you can't move from that position. So you're not as effective from that point of view. Mm-hmm. And then you don't have all the things that force you physically to push through.
Right.
You have the physical obstructions.
Yeah. You need
that kind of stuff to pass through. Yeah. Otherwise it just becomes like just, you know, too easy. You need the resistance. You know,
mm-hmm. That helps. Yep.
That's why Zazen is really important. I mean, there are other traditions that do, any tradition you do a long time, and I don't know very many others, but I know that Zazen does that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for sharing all your personal experiences. Thanks for listening to today's episode of the Redbeard Embodiment Podcast. To learn more, visit us at redbeardsomatictherapy.com. Or send me an email at alex@redbeardsomatictherapy.com. If today's conversation resonated with you, help spread the word by subscribing and sharing with others. Hope to see you next time.